Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Labor union membership in the U.S. hit a record low in 2018 when just over 1 in 10 American workers were card-carrying members. The drop-off is a result of economic, legislative, and judicial trends, including the U.S. Supreme Court decision last year that banned mandatory union dues for non-member public sector employees. But the decline has been decades in the making. An early blow occurred in 1947 with the enactment of the Taft-Hartley Act, which paved the way for anti-union right-to-work laws and established restrictions on strikes. As tens of thousands of General Motors workers wrap up a third week of a nationwide strike, an historian, a labor leader, and a prominent film two prominent film documentarians of the labor movement consider the past and the future of American labor today. The Wexner Center for the Arts has organized a 10-year documentary retrospective celebrating the work of Emmy Award nominee and three-time Academy Award nominee Julia Reichert. Netflix this week premiered her latest work titled American Factory, about how a Chinese manufacturer moved into a shuttered Dayton General Motors plant. We welcome Julie Reichert to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Also with us is her co-director of American Factory, Steve Bognar.
Hi, Ann.
Thanks. And also of Last Truck, which was the last time I talked with you, Julie. And I can't remember, Steve Bognar, I think you were on the air as well. If I remember correctly, but it was by phone. American Factory takes place in Dayton and China. Why did you decide that the Chinese piece was important enough to go there?
Well, when we started going into the factory back in 2015, we got permission to go in. And so it was fascinating and beautiful. So we went in, but we realized pretty quickly that not only were there 1,000 blue collar Americans, some of whom had actually worked at that GM plant, there were hundreds of Chinese workers. And we realized we don't know anything about them. These are folks, the Chinese, who got on a plane in a small city in China and got off the plane in Dayton, Ohio, to establish a life here for up to maybe two or more years. And we didn't know anything about them. We had the opportunity to go to China because, and it's kind of, there's a lot of humor in this trip, because the company chose 12 American supervisors, they were all white men, to go over there for kind of for training and inspiration to go over to the mother factory in southern China. And they did. And just seeing through their eyes how they experience China and Chinese workers and the worker celebration that happens at the end of every New Year's, which is, I think for most Americans, is going to be astounding to see. We had a chance to go, and we said, you know, we got to do it. So we did. We actually took a crew of six people over there, two native Chinese women who were our co-producers, who were great, and four of us Yanks, I guess you'd say, as Americans. So that's why we went. We were really, it was so good, and it's really fascinating in the film to see the work lives of the Chinese workers and the efficiency and the speed of the Chinese workers when you compare them to an American worker who's struggling to sort of learn how to. This is a glass factory,
right?
They make automotive glass. In fact, if you look at your vehicle, if you have a newer vehicle, look at the little bug on the side with glass of the glass and see if the word Fuyao is on there. That means it was manufactured in Moraine, Ohio, at this plant where we made the film. It's the largest auto glass factory in the world.
I was fascinated, Steve Bognar, by the impressions that were imparted by Chinese managers to the Chinese workers on what they could expect from American workers.
It is funny and surprising how one, you know, to hear someone describe an American who's not American, it does raise a lot of like stereotypes, you know, which luckily we've been really happy that when we've shown the film, Americans have a great ability. We have a great ability to laugh at ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so as you hear this in this sort of cultural education meeting, someone describing Americans, you can always tell an American when they're walking down the street because they're the person in the baggy shorts and the sloppy T-shirt.
Very casual.
Yes.
And they also – another comment which we loved is Here in America, you can even criticize the president yeah. and nobody will do anything to you.
Except for a guy with a Twitter account. But
anyway, yeah, it was fun. You know, it was really important to us to try to show multiple points of view in mm-hmm. the movie. We started making the film as Daytonians, you know, proud Ohioans, with a point of view of the blue collar American, Midwestern folks. But we realized those Chinese folks, mainly guys, they're missing their kids. They're not going to see their children, small children, for like 2 years. And we wanted to evoke and capture their story too.
It was interesting how much they misunderstood what they were getting into as well, Julia, that they, you know, like the president, this billionaire, you know, just kind of parachutes in and says, wow, Dayton's pretty developed. Or she says something
yeah,
like that. This is a big town.
Yeah.
Wow.
Chairman Chow, yeah, you know, he's an older guy. He's very successful. He's a multi-billionaire. He's very well known in China. He has 16 factories all over China. He has one in Germany and one in Russia. And he really, that's why the film was called American Factory, because for us, it's an American factory. It's like many, many other American factories. You know, tough working conditions, not a lot of regard for safety, not great wages now, especially since it was non-union. But for the chairman, it was his American factory. It was his American adventure. And, you know, you see in the film that he doesn't really understand American laws. If you remember, there's this funny scene where he's talking about the fire alarm system, which we all recognize we mm-hmm. have to have. And
right.
he's saying, well, that shouldn't be there. I don't like how that looks. Take it out. But you can't just, you know, you can't do that. So, but one of the things we really, this is a show about labor and the labor movement. Mm-hmm. In the film, if you take the last truck, which was 10 years ago when the General Motors plant closed and the economy basically was collapsing around us, mm-hmm. even though we didn't know, that forms the beginning of this film. That moment in December of 2008 when the General Motors plant closed, and then we fast forward to it opening, you know, surprisingly under Chinese ownership.
Yeah.
But what we see in the meantime, what we refer to is the fact that Americans, blue-collar Americans, have now come to accept lower and lower wages. The wages are really suppressed.
Just over $12 an hour.
Just over, yeah. You start at 12 an hour.
Well, you did. Now it's 14 an hour.
Yeah,
but
right.
as you saw in the film, when Fuyao opened, it was 12.
Right.
It was
wow.
12. Yeah, it was $12 an hour. And after 3 months, if you last, you get $12.84.
Yeah.
But still, and they do have good benefits, I will say. But American workers, we observed through making our films and radio shows and short films in the interim, American workers, at least in our area, have come to accept that they're going to be paid $10 to $12 an hour, where they used to feel they wouldn't take a job at that price. A union worker who had been in a union would not take a job. But now people have to at distribution centers, call centers, you know, whatever, at various workplaces that are just never going to pay those kind of wages. People really question in the film the American dream. Do we still have the American dream that if you work hard and you do your job, you'll get ahead? You can buy a house. You can have a car. You can send your kids to college.
You can buy their pair of tennis shoes when they want a pair of tennis shoes, as one of the,
yeah, exactly.
the people in the film
people
said.
People had that kind of life. That's like I'm from a working class union family, you know, a long time ago. My dad was a Republican union man. We had vacations. We owned our home. There was never a question of like, they're going to turn the lights off. We can't pay the bills, which people now face, working people.
And you contrast that notion of blue collar and union in the United States and the culture that grew up around it with the fact of these Chinese workers who left their home. They're not going to even get to go back and visit their families. And some of them, even those who live and work in the factories in China, go months without seeing their families. That's a completely different mindset.
It's a different culture.
Yeah. And one of the most exciting things that's happening with the film since it came out is it's become an underground viral hit in China.
Oh, I bet.
It's not officially approved for Chinese TV, but people are sharing it like crazy. Mm-hmm. And there's been at least 16 million comments on Chinese social media about the film. And
how do they feel?
The Economist, the British newspaper, did an article about it, and it said it's really sparking conversations about working conditions in China. There were quotes saying from
the
social media.
The glass pickers in the film.
Well, for example, people picking up shards of glass without real safety gloves, on their knees for full days. It's really hard, challenging work. The Economist quoted a couple people saying things like, we all know that China's success over these last 30 years is really built on the exploitation of labor from working people. Mm-hmm. And someone else said, the saddest thing is how normal this has become for all
of us. This is in China, people saying
that. Yeah. And so we always hoped the film would spark real conversation about the future of work. And we're just really excited it's happening, not just in the U.S., but in China.
Similar scenarios played out elsewhere 10, 15, 20 years ago when Japanese automakers started opening plants in the U.S. Julia Reichert, can you compare and contrast that? Was it the same sort of thing, or was there something different about this?
Well, I don't know a lot about that, but my impression is that the Japanese culture was not as heavily imposed, let's say, on the workers. I think the salaries started out better.
Back in the day.
I mean, there was questions of the Japanese are coming, but, we don't think about that anymore. I think now there's a huge rivalry in the global economy between the U.S. and China, and that's been going on it's like one of the big stories of the 21st century. And our film, globalization, right? Our film gives you insight into what that feels like on like a human level, in families and so forth. But one of the things I feel you really see in the work that I've done is the bargaining power of workers has gone down and down. And I think that has to do with why it is the wages are stagnant, why it is we have a growing billionaire class, not only in the U.S., but around the world. But average workers, don't have that, don't have a growing sense of hope and they can achieve the American dream. And I also think that as workers have less bargaining power and earn less money, it affects our schools, right? We don't have the tax base. If people getting $12 an hour, they aren't paying a lot of taxes.
And I'm just imagining that the Chinese company got a big tax break.
They did.
Yeah,
state of Ohio, Montgomery County, and Dayton.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Now, they did do what they were supposed to do. They did create jobs, and they sustained those jobs. But it affects our schools are very troubled in Dayton, our housing stock. There's a lot of empty houses. Our sort of general economy, the resilience of our city, I think we don't stop and think, well, that's connected to the fact that we don't have working class people don't have a truly living wage anymore. I think we should connect that in our minds. And I think the labor movement has to be strengthened through what happens in the White House, what happens in Congress. Labor laws need to be strengthened. Well, you've seen the film and you see somewhat flagrant violations of labor laws.
I wondered about that. I was watching it with my spouse and we were kind of watching it. And I'm like, wait a minute, they can't do
that.
They can't fire people for engaging in union organizing. It's against the law, isn't it?
It is against
officially,
the law.
They don't fire people for that. There's other reasons that people are fired. But
they make up other reasons.
Yeah, but there were wrongful termination claims and lawsuits filed against the company, and the company settled those. The company admits no wrongdoing, but they did pay monetary settlements to Jill, who's in the movie, and Cynthia, who's in the movie. They each received settlements.
Cynthia the blonde.
Jill is the woman, the blonde woman who lives in her sister's basement at the beginning of the movie.
Right. Yeah. I want to see Representative Fred Strayhorn of Dayton spoke to workers at a planning meeting for unionization, and you captured that in the film. Representative Strayhorn brought up the idea of how the labor movement built America. Let's listen.
Yeah.
The working people at Fuya right now who don't have a union, you have a birthright that's paid for by the sweat and blood of people in this room and people who have gone before people in this room, so that you had a right to a fair life, to a workplace that was safe. We fought these battles 70 years ago. We rejected 70 years ago that management and companies and rich people get to pick and choose what happens to you or what you get or what you don't get.
You know, you mentioned before we went on the air that that segment of the film is the most polemic that it gets. It's
right.
The most political that it gets. But you know, he's kind of, you know, rip-roaring.
He's given a rip-roaring speech.
Yeah.
Right. And we actually ended up cutting a lot of it. It's cut down.
Yeah, there's a lot more I cut.
Yeah. And there's, you know, you see from management point of view, from the chairman's point of view, that, you know, they have a different view. They feel like if we're going to make profit here, we cannot give more wages. You know,
it's more than just a view, though. It's just it's just absolutely
in
every fiber of their culture, every fiber of their body. They think it's absurd. And yet it's supposedly communist China.
The ironies compound as we filmed. You know, yes, you have the People's Republic, the you know, this sort of socialist country becoming the best capitalists in the world, right? Mm-hmm. And then they're the most vehemently anti-union, anti-workers organizing to support each other. Yeah. There's a lot of layers like that. When the union battle really ramps up in the movie, there's a lot of messaging. It's almost Orwellian, because they start to say, like, if you have a union, you won't be able to talk directly to your manager, right, and you will lose your voice.
Those are Americans saying that.
Yeah, it's a sort of an American playbook, a union avoidance playbook that's been developed and refined for decades. But they say things like, keep your voice, vote no against the union.
The right to work.
Yeah, same kind of language.
I should mention that there's another film we're showing at the Wexner Center. It's going to be next weekend. It's going to be a couple weeks from now, I think on the 18th of October. That's another it's a brand new film. Hardly anybody's ever seen it. And it gets more into the birth of these kind of union avoidance companies, which really have started in the late 70s and all through the 80s, 90s, and aughts have gained strength. And as Steve said, like, it's like a playbook now. That film is called 925, The Story of a Movement.
Okay.
And it's a women's I've made now two women's labor history films, one Union Maids, which will be shown this Saturday. And it's a rousing
Sunday.
This Sunday, yeah. It's a rousing film about the birth of the union movement from a woman's point of view.
It's a 1976
film.
And then we have 9 to 5, which is about the birth of white collar workers, secretaries, you know, like in the movie 9 to 5, the Dolly Parton movie, Dolly Parton, Jane Fonda. Jane Fonda's in the film. She's in the film. And it tells the story of the birth of that movement. So really, the films that I've made over 50 years now actually have touched on every decade of the 20th century and now every decade of the 21st century in terms of history of working people, history of social movements that have really, even though they're termed radical at the time,
became norms.
Became norms. Yeah. I mean, like the abolitionists.
Right.
Or the suffragists. They were radicals.
And that's why we're thrilled to have Julia Reichert on today. She's a documentary filmmaker, 50 years under her belt. Her latest work, American Factory, premiered in August on Netflix. Also with us, but we have to say goodbye to Steve Bognar. He's a film producer and one of the directors of American Factory. He works with Julia. Thank you so much for joining us, Steve.
Thank you, Anne.
We'll continue our conversation. By the way, the Wexner Center for the Arts has organized a 10-year documentary retrospective celebrating the work of Emmy Award nominee and 3-time Academy Award nominee Julia Reichert. For more information, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. There are free segments to this retrospective, so it's worth taking a look at. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Summertime means summer movies and movie music. I'm Jennifer Hambrick. Join me for a new season of Sound Reels, Classical 101's film music podcast. Explore moving musical storytelling and award-winning film scores by some of the world's top film composers. You can find the latest episodes of Sound Reels at wosu.org/classical101podcasts or by subscribing to Classical 101 Podcasts on your preferred platform.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Labor union membership in the U.S. hit a record low in 2018 when just over 1 in 10 American workers were card-carrying members. The drop-off is the result of economic, legislative, and judicial trends, including the U.S. Supreme Court decision last year that banned mandatory union dues for non-member public sector employees. But the decline has been decades in the making, and there's still work afoot to respond to it. Still with us, Emmy Award nominee and 3-time Academy Award nominee Julia Reichert. Welcome. Thanks again for joining us.
Sure.
The Wexner Center for the Arts has organized a 10-year documentary retrospective.
Actually, 50-year.
Oh. Okay.
I've been making movies for 50 years.
50-year documentary. Yep. You're right. Well, I don't know how 10-year.
I started
50-year documentary retrospective on Julie Reichert's work. For more information, go to the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Also joining us, historian of United States labor, immigration, and empires, Julie Green, joining us by Skype. Welcome.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Also, president of the Ohio AFL-CIO, Tim Berga. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann.
Tim Berga, you know, I described the state of the labor movement in a metric that I can easily understand, which is how many card-carrying members are out there. How do you describe the state of the labor movement today?
Well, you've touched on some really important topics today. In 1983, 20% of the American workforce was unionized. Today, it's just around 11%, just under 13% in Ohio. Mm-hmm. There's a tremendous disconnect between the tremendous wealth that's being created for corporations and the earnings of hardworking Americans and workers around the globe, and largely in response to the decline of union membership. There's a whole host of reasons that are policy made that's got us into this predicament, but that's why your show is so important here today.
Julie Green, the history of the labor movement in the United States, it must look like a bell curve at this point, right?
Well, that's right. But I think it's important to keep in mind that we have to measure the health of labor, not just by the organized union movement, but by all kinds of social movement activities. So what folks are saying, pointing out, is absolutely right. You know, the federal government just released statistics that inequality in this mm-hmm. country is higher than it has been since the Census Bureau started gathering this data 50 years. The minimum wage has been so low for decades. If it had kept pace with inflation, we would be up to about a $30 an hour minimum wage. So tremendous problems. And fundamentally, the problem for the union movement is that it's tougher to organize a union and to achieve union rights in this country than in any other part of the industrialized world. Mm-hmm. But I would add to that, that labor in this country has always been strong, not just because of unions, although they're the leaders of fighting for workers' rights, but also because of activism outside of it. And that's especially important today when we've had 33 states raise the minimum wage, mostly because of what scholars call the alt-labor movement, mm-hmm. alternative labor activities. It's become so hard to fight as a union in this country that increasingly achievements need to be made as well from social movement strategies outside of traditional unionism.
And Julia Reichert, your work spans decades and decades, looking all the way back, mm-hmm. you know, to the beginnings of the labor movement. And some of your work is focused on, as you mentioned earlier in the program, on women and who were largely left behind, also minorities, even by the organized labor movement itself for a long time. It wasn't perfect in and of itself.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, you know, what institution
in the, is,
and I think unions have taken such a beating in the media over time. But I do want to point out something that Tim mentioned to me earlier, that the attitude of Americans toward unions has really shifted. You know, I think
recently,
there was
pretty positive.
Yeah, we're seeing public opinion polling that we haven't seen since the 1950s in terms of union favorability.
What happened to the idea and the common notion that unions were the backbone of the middle class in this country? How did that lose its footing?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's lost. You see peaks and valleys in terms of public opinion, but we're seeing worker uprisings now that we haven't seen in a generation.
The teachers
walking off the jobs in West Virginia and Oklahoma, not terribly blue states, right? Saying enough is enough. We shouldn't have to teach our kids and then go home and get a second job to pay the bills. Workers at Google walking off the job. So we're seeing worker uprisings like we haven't seen in a generation. And we're public opinion is very high. And MIT did a study and asked, found that there are 60 million Americans not in a union job today. If they had the opportunity tomorrow to be in a union, they would be. So you're seeing a lot of interest, and a lot of Americans don't really understand what the trade union movement is or collective bargaining is, but they understand if they take the person at work next to them and grab them both by the arm and say, let's go have a voice at work, that they know they're stronger together. And that's really starting to take off.
Julie Green, what do we know about what precedes these kinds of uprisings, if you want to call them that?
Well, you know, something like 2018, for example, when we saw more workers on strike than since 1986, and most of those were teachers. You look at the teachers' movement, that uprising was more than a decade in the making. So it was about teachers having faced falling pay, increased class sizes, decreased resources available to students. Really, Chicago was the heart, as it is the heart today. Chicago teachers just voted to go on strike later this month. And in terms of the teacher strikes, one of the really fascinating things about it gets at what was just being said a minute ago, was that teachers successfully have framed their movement as necessary, not only for themselves and their families and to regain a sort of middle class standard of living, but important for the entire community and particularly for their students. So they've been able very effectively to strike back at the notion that the labor movement is just about workers being selfish, right? That they're showing that this is a social movement that benefits the entire community.
Well, don't we, I mean, Julie, don't we want to have a middle class in this country, you know, people who can actually go out and buy stuff and keep the economy going? I think when you have wage stagnation like we have, which I personally think is very related to the decline of unions. I mean, even if you're not in a union, if you're surrounded by people who are, your wages are going to be better. And one of the things you really see in the film, which to me was a revelation, something I didn't know and I don't think most people know about, is the union avoidance industry, which Julie will probably know started in the
70s. Yeah.
The idea that there are highly paid consultants who come into workplaces, they could be a university, they could be a factory, to really put on a campaign to avoid the union. And what you see in our film are things that are borderline illegal and actually illegal. And with that having gone on now, and, you know, for decades, since the late 70s, right, Julie, that's when it started. That's when the decline of the union movement actually began, is like in the 80s, 90s, and so forth. And most people don't realize that the elections that often happen in factories, right, like the one in Chattanooga, there was UAW, was that you? That was Volkswagen. They lost. The UAW lost the election. But what you don't, you think, oh, well, the union was bad. They didn't want the union. But what you don't realize, there's a very intense campaign within that factory to keep people from understanding what a union really is, that tends to lead people to get fired and so forth. And that's, to me, we believe in fair elections in our country, right? We believe in that. We believe in democracy. What about democracy at the workplace? What about fair, free elections? We did not see that in our film. Don't you agree? Because you've seen the film.
That's definitely the case. What you're seeing in union campaign, organizing campaigns, one after the other, is fear and intimidation campaigns by the employer. And by the time you get a ruling on a unfair labor practice, and then there's, you know, it's too late then, right? And then the penalties. So we saw it at Fuyao. In the film, you'll see that they have captive audience meetings in which they have these so-called labor consultants come in and talk about, you know, why the union's not good. What many people don't know is elected officials get involved in these campaigns. We saw maybe two dozen state representatives here in Ohio send letters to those employees in that Fuyao plant saying, beware of these outside forces, which were the unions. So we need policy changes, and this is a good place and a good opportunity to put in a plug for the Protect the Right to Organizing Act that's been introduced in the U.S. House, both in the Senate and the House. If your listeners would call their members of Congress and say they need to support the Protect the Right to Organizing Act, it would put penalties in for employers interfering and intimidating with union drives. It would allow for no delays in the union election, and it would allow the first contract to be happen. Half of all union organizing drives that are successful, they don't have a first contract a year later.
Right.
One third of all union campaigns result in somebody working to get the union in there results in somebody being fired. These are things that the PRO Act would remedy, and that would go a long way into the labor law reform that we've been needing now for decades.
I agree, Tim. And it's like the PRO Act. So let's make sure to ask our legislators where they stand on that.
We are going to take a break. I have to say goodbye to Julia Reichert. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. This was fun.
Julia Reichert is a documentary filmmaker. Her latest work, American Factory, premiered in August on Netflix. The Wexner Center for the Arts has organized a 50-year documentary retrospective celebrating the work of Emmy Award nominee and three-time Academy Award nominee Julia Reichert. For more information, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We are interested in what you think about this. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the labor movement in the United States, the history of it, where it stands today. Still with us, President of the Ohio AFL-CIO, Tim Berger. Thanks again for joining us, Tim. Also with us by Skype, Julie Green. She's an historian. She studies U.S. labor, immigration, and empire. Julie, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
What about labor migration and how that fits into the history of the labor movement, Julie? How important has that been over time?
Well, super important, right? We need workers historically all across American history, even before the U.S. was a nation. We relied on labor of people often brought from elsewhere, whether it was the coerced migration of enslaved men and women, or whether it was immigrants from Ireland or Germany or onward to Italians and Eastern Europeans. Today, it remains hugely important. And so one of the most important themes in American labor history is this history of how are the people who are migrating to the U.S. to help build America, how are they treated? They've faced historically xenophobia and, you know, hostile sentiment, and that remains true today as well. So it's a super important theme. In the 19th century, there was a little bit of a sense that Western Europeans, the Irish and Germans, even though they faced hostility, there was a sense that we needed them to settle America, to help the country expand across the continent. And so that tempered the xenophobia a little bit. In the 20th century, much of the story of the 20th century is the story of wanting cheap labor, wanting migrants to come. And so you have, by the mid-20th century, you have increasing numbers of Mexicans encouraged to come across the border. But then as hostility peaks, you see movements to, like, Operation Wetback, for example, in the 1950s. You see efforts to push them back out of the country. And so creating certain groups of labor migrants as kind of disposable sources of labor has become an important theme as well.
Tim Berger, how has the labor movement changed over the last 30 years in response to the efforts at the legislative and judicial level to control it more?
Yeah, organized labor is still the equalizer in today's economy. We're just not growing at the rate that we need to be, and it's for a lot of reasons, and we talked about some of it already. Mm-hmm. Labor law reform, specifically related to organizing. Our trade and tax policy, automation now, and businesses that are acting as banks rather than as innovators and manufacturers.
Also
now.
Globalization.
And globalization.
You're competing not against the people in the next town, the people in the next continent.
Right. So these are all policies made by people and elective bodies and world governing bodies. And we've laid out very clearly what we believe the problems are. We got to get to the business of making the future of work and tomorrow's economy being shaped by workers, not global corporate interests.
Jerome in Marysville, you're on the air. Hi, Jerome.
Hi. Thank you for having me on again. I just wanted to explain why over the years I have become less supportive of unions. To get down to it, the superintendent and her lawyer of the school district my children went to flat out told me to my face they refused to enforce the harassment policy because the union contract supersedes the law.
So,
and they refused to do anything.
What about that? I mean, some people have complained that unions got kind of there's all different kinds of examples, particularly when it comes to public employees and things like that, Tim Berger. And I know that's not your, you know, that's not your wheelhouse, but.
No, that's fine. I mean, when you look at public employment in the state of Ohio prior to the collective bargaining law in 1983, it was a public sector in disarray. You had work stoppages, you have strikes. What the collective bargaining law in the state of Ohio put in place in 1983 has brought order to our public employee sector. And as a result, you have a collaborative arrangement between whether it's a school board or whether it's a city government, a public entity with the workers, and they craft out an agreement, a collective bargaining agreement, and it has created great stability, gives the public entity the opportunity to budget around it, and has created fairness and middle-class opportunities for workers. So the collective bargaining law in the state of Ohio, and we remember in 2011 when the General Assembly and the governor was looking to undo the collective bargaining law with Senate Bill 5,
right.
That Ohioans said, we're not having that. In fact, they passed the law by one vote in the House, one vote in the Senate. We got 1.2 million signatures to overturn the law. And by a 2-to-1 margin, the voters in Ohio said, we want the collective bargaining law. It's the only time in American history that I'm aware of that collective bargaining has actually been on a statewide ballot where the people have said, we want the union because we know it sets the bar for the standard of living for the rest of us.
Jerome, thanks a lot for that call. Larry in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Larry.
Hi. You have such great shows all the time. I love listening to you.
Thank you.
I have been concerned for a while that a lot of retirees who benefited from the union movement in the mid-century, late mid-century, I grew up outside of Detroit. I knew a lot of people that were in unions. And I talk to them now, and they're all voting for people who are anti-union.
Is that, you know, I'm interested. It's an interesting point of view, and I want to ask Tim Berger about that. But Julie Green, is there something that has happened in the past? Is that part of this issue? I got mine, so.
Well, I think it's a much bigger, more complicated issue than I got mine, and so screw you coming after me. Mm-hmm. I think that to the extent that white, older male workers voted Republican, voted for Trump, I think it has to do with the larger context of economic crisis in this country and a feeling of desperation, not knowing what to do and wanting, feeling like the country needed perhaps a radical change. The ways in which the country has not recovered, particularly working Americans, have not recovered since the 1907-08 recession, has meant tremendous pain. The capital flight, the globalization of the economy that was referenced earlier, all of those things have made average working Americans' lives difficult. And older Americans, retirees, face it tremendously. They're facing retirement with no or very little savings. Many workers saw their pensions eliminated. So there's very, very deep anxiety around all of these issues. And I think that's a big part of it. I would also say, you know, look at the UAW strike happening now against GM. Mm-hmm. That's an example of older workers going on strike to support more recently hired workers. So I don't think it's accurate to say that there's always this trend of older workers not caring about those coming up behind them. At the heart of the UAW strike is an effort by workers who were hired before 2007 and make higher wages, going on strike to help those in the second tier, those who are paid lower wages because they were hired after 2007.
Tim Berger, there is this image, though, of the Ohio AFL-CIO, UAW, and that kind of thing, and Julie Green's point taken for sure, but that they're middle-aged or older white males disaffected but benefited from the union movement themselves. What do you make of that? Do you think it's maybe not as accurate as Larry put it there?
Well, I mean, everybody has their personal observations, and you know, Larry has his, and my experience with the retirees in particular in the state of Ohio, they're very strong in support of the union movement. What we're seeing now in terms of all of our public opinion polling within our own ranks is the approval level and satisfaction level of our members of their own union. It is true in the state of Ohio like this, where we've lost 320,000 manufacturing jobs, mostly good-paying union jobs that have been either outsourced or offshored, that there are a lot of working-class Ohioans that have feel like they've been left behind. And they see things like NAFTA that was supported by both parties, and they've lost where they maybe generally would take their cues from. Then they're trying to figure out what their next job looks like with the industrial economy being decimated here. And along comes somebody who wants to tell them everything that they think they want to hear and stoke fear and all sorts of things to get them thinking about, going a different way, right? And we've seen this, what I call pretend populism now, out of this White House and out of this administration, where people are realizing their lives aren't getting better. We're not getting those factories back that he said we were going to get back. We're not getting the overtime bay that the Obama administration put in, that the Trump administration will no longer defend. So it's true that there's been some movement of blue-collar Democrats looking at, more Republican opportunity, where we're seeing the more emerging of the female vote, especially in the big city suburbs, looking more, you know, at the Democrats. So there's been some movement around. But at the end of the day, when things settle, people are going to look at what are the policies that are helping me in my life and my own economic condition. And so I think things kind of bounce back and forth based sometimes on candidates and the mood of the moment. But the union movement and our membership, one thing that they tell us time and again is they believe in their union. They have faith in their union.
Chris in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Ann, how are you today?
Fine, thank you. Go ahead.
Good. Hey, I just wanted to talk a little bit about a couple of different issues that y'all are talking about. One is, before the economic collapse of 2008-2009, I worked on the railroad, which is one of the last real good-paying union jobs in this country. Two things. They started us out at 80% and bumped us up. Just that's what the UAW is fighting against now. Even though they needed people desperately, the unions had to agree to that 20% cut for new workers. And I worked, and every year I got 5% until I finally made 100% of the salary that I should have come in with. But the question I had is, have any of y'all ever heard of job insurance?
Mm-mm. Can you be more specific?
In a railroad, because the companies are hate their workers so much and are so anti-union, they hate the union employees, they would fire people for just about any sort of minor infraction. Well, a whole industry grew up around that, where these small companies would sell the railroad men this thing called job insurance. And what it was is you would pay premiums to the small company, insurance company, and when you were fired from some trumped-up charge, what would happen is the union would put in a grievance with the National Labor Relations Board, and it'd take up to a year. And during that time, the workers out of work, the job insurance would pay their full salary until the National Labor Relations Board ruled one way or the other. And so that's all I had to say.
Which gives people more of a foothold when it comes to time to strike. Julie Green, we're running out of time. I kind of wanted to get a sense about what you think about where the General Motors nationwide strike, where that fits into what we're talking about now and going forward. What do you think the chances are that they'll prevail, the strikers?
I think there's a very good chance. The strike is very strong. GM is losing money. Its supply is dwindling. I think the strike is a very, very important event when you put it in historical context, especially the last decade or so. You know, I mentioned earlier that we had more strikes in 2018 than we had seen since 1986, but almost all of those were in public unionism. Those were predominantly teachers. Another big group was hotel workers. Mm-hmm. So we had not seen a big strike in manufacturing like this for some time. It's really important, I think, when we're talking about, you know, the decline of the labor movement, to keep in mind that where it's still strong is in public unionism. Somewhere around 30 to 35% of public workers are unionized. Also, really important to keep in mind that the working class as a whole now is predominantly working in the service sector, predominantly is men and women of color, especially women. And so they're often at the forefront of mobilizations today and in the last decade or so. But the UAW still, which is, you know, has one of the highest proportions of African-American workers, but still predominantly white workers. Mm-hmm. The UAW going on strike like this in the heart of U.S. manufacturing is a really exciting development, especially because it's about solidarity across these tiers that had been created. You know, UAW workers had given back to the automobile industry a lot of concessions back during the 2008 recession. And so now they're fighting to kind of regain some of what they had given back at that time.
Julie Green, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you, Anne.
Julie Green, historian of United States labor, immigration, and empire, and Tim Berger, president of the Ohio AFL-CIO. Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Anne.
That's it today. Thanks to the AllSides staff, producer Mary Lee Williams, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, AllSides interns Atiyah Ture, Tatiana Woodall, and Bobby Gerberic, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks again. This is AllSides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.